We used to live on the Atlantic coast, a few miles from the ocean and just a few blocks from the intercoastal waterway. I've had a really tough life. But first, when we moved down there, we moved into a manse, and we were there for about 4 years, and then that was just blocks from the beach. And then we moved into a home of our own a few miles inland, which was the first time that we had been responsible for the upkeep of a whole property. I think we'd been there for like 3 months before it occurred to me nobody else was coming to mow the lawn. Part of that property included a lovely rustic backyard. And there was a little boxed-in area in part of that backyard where the previous owners apparently had a little garden. So for the first time in my life, I decided I would try my hand at a vegetable garden. Well, it's sand. One of my plantings was a habanero plant, and I figured that by late summer I'd be adding some exotic fire to chili and tacos and soups and anything else I could get away with. In the event, the result of one full summer of nurturing, watering, weeding, hoping, tending. At the end of that full summer, there was a yield of exactly one tiny habanero pepper. Which I put in a crock pot full of chili and you couldn't even tell it was in there. I also produced a handful of green bell peppers that were about the size that you'd want if your Barbie doll was having a cookout. I grew an eggplant that looked remarkably like a doorknob, except a little smaller. And a cucumber about the size of a sausage link. So it was a great, great summer. It's a poor work person who blames his or her tools, but the ground, I blame myself, but this was not rich soil. One of our church members one time handed me some gorgeous bok choy. The leaves were just dark green. It was fresh and beautiful. He'd grown it in his own garden. He lived closer to the beach than we did. And I said, "What in the world did you do to grow it so amazingly and beautifully?" And he said, "Just plant it and water it." Less than 2 minutes later, we're still in the same room. I'm hearing him in conversation with somebody else, and he casually mentions, "Yeah, we brought in 5 tons of topsoil." Okay, so, but other than a massive whole-scale re-topographication of your lawn, you didn't really do anything special. Anyway, this is just for me right now. Back in my garden, and indeed the whole sizable yard, which did not have the benefit of topographical reconstruction, what we had was sand, stubborn, lifeless sand that seemed to leak like a sieve all the way down to the water table. There was just enough soil in it to allow a few things to grow a little. And one thing I noticed that grew a lot. It only took a minute or less of really paying close attention to see a weed in the form of a vine. You might notice one vine in the crabgrass, and then you'd notice that it was all over the crabgrass, and then you'd sort of notice most of this is not crabgrass. Most of this is that weedy vine, or viney weed. And then you'd notice that it was all over and under the lawn everywhere. You could dig around it, and you could probably try to pull and pull and pull, but you got the sense that it was thousands of miles long, interwoven like a ball of yarn, or like the inside of a golf ball. You ever seen one of those split and all that stuff in there? You could imagine, I pictured it went all the way down to the center of the earth. I just assumed that's what's holding us all together. I always felt like if you could get a good enough grip on it and just start pulling, you'd risk unraveling the whole lawn and maybe the surrounding acreage, like when you pull a string on a sweater and on. That vine seemed to be binding everything together, and much as I might try to get rid of just a little bit of it, there was always more, inconceivable amounts more. "Have regard for this vine," said the people in the Palestinian wilderness, a vulnerable, hunted, haunted people, the Jews, defeated, beaten down, despised, isolated, mocked, and constantly imperiled. Have regard for this vine, O God. You planted us here in love, and there are many who would try to rip us from the ground. We know, O God, that we have disappointed your hopes. We were your pleasant planting that should have been abundantly fruitful with sweet and rich fruits, but have so often yielded only bitter, sour grapes. You established an order for us where there was enough for all, but it turned out that it was easier to bring us out of Pharaoh's land than to bring Pharaoh's system out of us. And we hoarded our resources just like Pharaoh. And we competed with our neighbors. And we took advantage of everybody who couldn't keep up with us. And we called that your blessings. And now we live in terror of the poverty that we invented. And living in that terror, we make sure that the poor don't get powerful enough to threaten to take away the surpluses around which we have built our lives. Restore us, Lord God of hosts. Let your face shine, that we may be saved. And in that restoration and that mercy, remind us, O God, about the great cloud of witnesses, the vine to which by your mercy alone we are connected. Turn again, says the psalm, turn again, look down from heaven and see. Have regard for this vine, the stock that your right hand planted. The Hebrew there could also be translated, look down from heaven, perceive this land, behold it, consider it, and visit this vine. Take care of this vine. Vines are persistent. You can try to control them, but they grow and spread because that's exactly what they were created to do. You can't always tell where vines begin or end. They can hold together patches of earth, pieces of the world that would otherwise crumble. They're not very good at staying in their lane because they seem to know instinctively, as if it were planted deep in their DNA, that all the lanes are God's lanes. Friedrich Schleiermacher in the early 1800s called it a feeling of absolute dependence at our core, a kernel of awareness within each of us, of an absolute dependence that we have on something infinitely greater and truer and more real even than ourselves, namely the God who made and redeemed and loves and sustains us. Those who remain connected to the vine, those who remain connected to God, dependent on God, cognizant of God, who know that God has regard for them, and who themselves have regard, therefore, for all God's people and all God's creation, those who are part of the endless vine, are authorized to reach into the world with love, embracing it deeply, surrounding it, encompassing it. The same way that God's love is a vine that runs through your life, surrounding you, enveloping you, nourishing you. The only person who can even try to tell the vine of God's love in your life to stay in its lane is you, which, thank God, doesn't usually work out for very long. But the blaring voices of our time, with its contempt and cynicism and heartlessness, can sometimes threaten to drown out the memories and the dreams and even the mission of the people of God, the followers of Christ. And when the seed of the Word of God falls on hardened path or rocky ground or among thorns, or when the fruits of what we thought would be our seasons of growing and flourishing come out small and stunted and don't seem to have much effect, I remember the vine to which we are connected. The prophets through whom God conquered kingdoms and administered justice. the political prisoner witnesses to God's love, who never sold out despite the fact that it could have been their get-out-of-jail-free card. The saints of whom the world was not even worthy, who suffered the most appalling and abominable degradations for the sake of good news to the poor and release for the captives and recovery of sight to the blind and to let the oppressed go free. I remember the vine, and I remember the witness. Vedran Smilovich was the cellist who went out in the wreckage during the siege of Sarajevo back in the early 90s, where Bosnian Serb nationalists had sent mortar fire into a crowd of people lined up for bread, and where snipers continually tormented the city and had no qualms about targeting hospitals, schools, libraries. Vedran Smilovich was a member of the Sarajevo Philharmonic Orchestra, and he would put on his coat in the middle of that siege. He'd put on his coat and tails, and he'd take out his cello and a music stand, and he'd set them up right in the wreckage, which was still a target, insistently giving music to the lamentation of the city, and uncompromisingly choosing to impose beauty on what others were trying their worst to turn into hell. We don't know the name of the Chinese dissident in Tiananmen Square back in 1989. Remember that guy who went and stood in front of the tank, and then the tank would move to go around him, and he'd just move and stand, and it looked like he had a grocery bag or something, like it couldn't be just a more normal-looking, everyday, ordinary, vulnerable human. He stood in front of those tanks that the government, one tank in particular, that the government had sent in to crush the students who were demanding democracy. And he'd keep moving to make sure that he was always in front of that tank, daring it to run him over before the world's cameras. We don't know his name, and probably never will. Somebody pointed out, I wish I could remember who to credit, whoever this thinker was, but years ago somebody pointed out that nor will we probably ever know the name of the tank driver who could have crushed that demonstrator into the pavement, but never did. And we can imagine probably suffered for that decision at the hands of a regime whose patience eventually ran out along with its conscience and its humanity. In both the vulnerability of that dissident and the restraint of the tank driver with immense power at his or her disposal, we get a glimpse of what we can be and what we can do with the part of the vine that runs through our lives. There's an Ethiopian priest whose church was built by missionaries who brought Christianity to Ethiopia back in the late 5th century. The church is carved into a cliffside over an 820-foot drop and can only be reached by a climb that includes narrow ledges and at least one 32-foot-long section of sheer vertical cliff that has to be scaled without shoes or a rope. This guy walks 2 hours in the early morning just to get to the foot of that cliff to start the climb, and by all indications, he loves what he does. You or I may question the wisdom or the sanity or the value of that, noting particularly that going to that church is not only a voluntary but a solitary activity. It's not like there are families coming for services on Sunday morning. The priest studies and prays alone. Well, why bother? Why didn't he just go to his local library? But he and thousands of other women and men like him carry out the monastic charge every day, all over the world, in all kinds of circumstances, and you and I can know that somewhere, up high mountains, in ancient ruins, alone or in community, in every nation, there are dedicated people who are praying to God for us and on our behalf around the clock. Martin Luther King delivered a sermon in Atlanta on February 4th, 1968, which just 2 months before he died, in which he said, "Jesus gave us a new norm of greatness, If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that the one who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's your new definition of greatness. And it means that everybody can be great because everybody can serve. You don't have to have a college degree to serve. You don't have to make your subject and your verb agree to serve. You don't have to know about Plato and Aristotle to serve. You don't have to know Einstein's theory of relativity to serve. You don't have to know the second theory of thermodynamics and physics to serve. You only need a heart full of grace, a soul generated by love, and you can be that servant. There's a program in Charlotte called Samaritan's Feet. It was founded by a guy from Nigeria named Manny Ohome. Samaritan's Feet gives shoes to poor kids, and when they do it, they wash their feet. Cody Zeller is a 7-foot-tall basketball player from Indiana who plays for the Charlotte Hornets. He wears a size 16 shoe. And he said, you know, I can't even imagine if you're a kid and you wear a size 16, where does a parent find those shoes? Even if you can afford them, they're hard to find. So he donated 200 pairs of size 16 shoes. And Manny Ohome said, it's pretty amazing. You've got a volunteer like Cody Zeller on one side and me on the other side, the kids sitting right in front of us. We ask what their names are and what their dreams are. And this is while we are washing their feet. We're asking them, how do you want to change the world? We put on these new shoes and say, now use these shoes to go change the world. Mother Maria Skoltsova wrote, the eyes of love will perhaps be able to see how Christ himself departs quietly and invisibly from the sanctuary at the end of the worship service. The singing resounds, clouds of incense arise, the faithful are overcome by the beauty of the services. That's an Orthodox tradition. But Christ will go out onto the church steps and mingle with the crowd, the poor, the lepers, the desperate, the embittered, the holy fools. Christ will go out into the streets, the prisons, the low haunts and dives, again and again. In a long poem called Instructions to Painters and Poets by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who was one of the beat poets from the mid-20th century, he wrote, I asked 100 painters and 100 poets how to paint sunlight on the face of life. It seems to me all you have to do is conceive of the whole world and all humanity as a kind of artwork, an art project of the God of light. Paint yourself in your true colors, in primary colors, as you see them, without whitewash. And don't forget to paint all those who lived their lives as bearers of light. And when you finish your painting, stand back astonished. You brought a vine out of Egypt. You drove out the nations and planted it. You cleared the ground for it. It took deep root and filled the land. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, who for the sake of the joy that was set before him endured the cross, disregarding its shame, and has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of God.